Welcome to this very lightly edited recording of the first 35 or 40 minutes of the Challenge the City event that happened on December 3rd, 2014 at the Laughing Buddha in Sudbury, Ontario. My name is Scott Nye, a member of the organizing and editorial collective of the Sudbury Working Group of the Media Co-op and the facilitator of this event. We brought together representatives of the Sudbury Coalition Against Poverty, the Sudbury and District Labor Council, and the Coalition for a Livable Sudbury to talk about their different approaches to working for change at the local level. First up, you will hear first Christy Knockleby, the recording starts a few words into her remarks, and then Anna Harbulik of the Sudbury Coalition Against Poverty, speaking briefly about the work that they do and the choices they make as they challenge the city.
Of helping those who are struggling to make it in the city, who are living in poverty, we work with ODSP and OW clients, helping them when they're having trouble with being denied access to benefits that they were entitled to. And we're involved in some larger campaigns. And Anna is going to speak now about what we've been doing with the effort to get the emergency homeless shelter going. And that gives a good example of how we work, what strategies we use.
Okay, so I'm going to go through a lot of the process from last year, and starting with what changes we were working towards and how we determined the demands that we were making. What we demand and the campaigns that we participate in and the things that we fight for come out of the real needs of people living in poverty and the working poor. So, those needs come to be known to us through the direct action support work that we do, assisting individuals in their day-to-day struggles, meeting those basic needs. And with this particular issue of there not being an emergency winter shelter open at all last year, and the city not talking about it at all, we had people who came to us, like a number of people who came to us with different problems related to that overall one. There was the problem that you needed $25, you needed to pay $25 or to have a voucher to access the main men's shelter downtown. Other people had problems not accessing the shelter because they didn't have identification. There were First Nations people who had negative experiences due to a number of factors existing in the shelter options that were available, such as like really rigid structures and rules and restrictive hours and a history of past negative experiences with staff at some of the shelters. And First Nations people and others also talked about the religious character of the people running shelters being a problem. So from there were more things. There were people who were living in poverty and homeless people who needed to access a shelter, but the shelter spaces weren't accessible to people who used wheelchairs, and there were no shelters that were open on a drop-in basis every night of the winter. We had one option where people could go in as to get warm throughout the night, but they weren't able to sleep. And obviously, that painted us a picture of like a set of barriers to accessing shelter that we needed to address, and those created our demands around the campaign. And the main strategies that we used in fighting for an emergency winter shelter that addressed all of those barriers was basically an escalation of tactics leading to direct action. So that began with like lower level activities that are deemed like acceptable by the state, that are easy to participate in, like letter writing. I think we wrote I'm jumping ahead. I think we wrote city councilors and like the mayor outlining the demands that came out of the work that we did and demanding action and demanding that a shelter be open now because that's the immediate need that needed to be met. And we utilized like the media, social media. We did outreach through leafleting and postering to ensure that there was like a lot of support for the campaign among like people who were affected by the issue and also like supporters of people living in poverty and homeless people. And also we were open about like the steps that we had taken and how the city hadn't moved as a result of some of those like lower level tactics. So then we had to move up to the next thing that we engaged in after those lower level types of things were disruptions. We disrupted a first of all, we had to determine like what type of disruption makes sense, and we did that by like mapping social relations to target the people and places where decisions are being made in the city. And we identified the person in charge of shelters and homelessness and the director of community and social services and the general manager of community development, is it?
Yeah.
And ultimately the city council as the larger decision-making body that has authority on those actors. So we disrupted the city council meeting and at the beginning of a meeting and chanted just that we demanded emergency shelter be open immediately, and we demanded that they address it at that meeting. And this type of action is really important because I want to emphasize that we don't need to be given space by the local state to voice our demands or space. We don't need to be invited by them to communicate our needs. We need just collective power. There's power in numbers, and like we went there and demanded that our voices be heard, and that's what was really important about that type of action.
We use disruption as a way of putting pressure on the politicians. We use it when we go in to help an individual who is having trouble getting ODSP or OW. We can go in and disrupt the day of the supervisors, just taking a crowd in. And it's something where it goes past some people's comfort level to go in and disrupt, to take action. And yet, because the issues we're dealing with are important and in many cases very time crucial, people can't wait for another council meeting. They can't wait half a year for these decisions. They need help now. And so we go in, and it has proved very effective. To a limited extent, we win things, but then the city tends to claw them back. We also try to work with councillors, the councillors who have been willing to cooperate, and bring our issues up. We don't know whether we're going to have that ability with this next group of councillors.
Next, you hear the introductory remarks from Jamie West, the president of the Sudbury and District Labour Council, about their approaches to change.
So I'm Jamie West. I'm the president of the Sudbury District Labour Council. And just as a thumbnail sketch of who we are, we're considered Labour's official voice in the city. So they want to know what the right-wing thinks and business thinks. They go to Chamber of Commerce, and they want to know what Labour thinks, and they come to us. And a variety of other groups, but one of the people who has that in. So we function as part of a hierarchy in organized labour. So there's the CLC that organizes across the country. There's federations of labor for each province. So ours is Ontario Federation of Labor. And then here, civically, we have the Sudbury District Labor Council. And we work with the various affiliate unions that are here, primarily with unions. We also have allies who are into, you know, social justice. And more we're reaching out to them and pulling social justice groups into what we do because we're fighting for the same things, right? So it makes no sense for us to be divided based on where you're employed. So in general, what we're working towards is being the voice of the progressive. We want to get the voice out there. In general, there's a loud minority out there, boisterous bullying, and I find people with reasonable decision-making powers don't want to engage and are more silent. And so you see it in the newspaper forums and stuff where there's people just shouting down other people. There isn't a conversation. There's just a shouting match and a bullying stream. So what I see and what I've experienced is a lot of frustration with this arrogance, and there isn't that dialogue. So what we try to participate in activities like this, where we have like-minded people talking about stuff and encouraging them to be vocal about their points of view, because there's people who support them and believe in them too. An example of something that we're working on actually right now, I wrote the letter on Monday about our store hours. And if you look at the last election, you know, the extending, deregulating our store hours, it sounds like this utopia where businesses will choose to stay open if they want to, and the workers will choose their hours they want to work, and the citizens are choose when they can go shopping. And realistically, it isn't cut and dry like that. So small businesses aren't on a level playing field with a large business. You know, a mom and pop and a Walmart are not on a level playing field. The mom and pop store, they quit at 5 o'clock and they make supper and go home with their family. A Walmart's open 24 hours a day. I'm not paying a Walmart, even Toys R Us, Canadian Tire, any of these larger businesses, retail places. They're open at night stocking their shelves. They're open at night with janitorial staff cleaning up. And they have a 24-hour operation already. They just don't do sales after 9 p.m. So if you're a small business and you've shut down completely, it isn't as simple as just opening a cash or a self-checkout. You've got to hire people to stock. You've got to get security in there. You have to have transportation, lighting, and everything. So your costs are a lot higher in order to compete. And you can't choose not to compete. You compete or you go to the business. And you see that right now with Sunday shopping. And Sunday shopping is decades ago that it came through here. But there aren't a lot of businesses that choose not to be open on a Sunday, right? You have to be pretty specialized in a niche market. There's issues with worker safety. There's lack of transit. There isn't public transit basically after midnight. There's a bunch of sort of milk runs that will bring you downtown at 1:30 in the morning, but after that you're done, right? So how do you get out there? If you want to shop, how do you get there in the first place? If you're working and you want an affordable transit system, how do you get to work and back? There's safety in terms of at night, fewer people around. The majority of people are asleep, right? So there isn't a lot of visibility for you. There isn't a lot of lighting for you. There isn't transit, so there'll be more people on feet or driving. You know, people get rowdy after going to bars, and it might be fun to go out to a retail place and throw tennis balls around and do whatever. So there's things like that, and there's actual health effects to working shift work. It's a known carcinogen, this shift work and going lack of sleep. Staying awake for more than 16 hours has the same health effects as being under the influence of alcohol, you know, your lower limit for driving a car. So there's all these issues that don't really exist, and we're being sold the side story of it and not being told all the facts, and it sounds great. But realistically, workers aren't going to choose their hours at a retail store. It's no different than a guy who works 9 to 5 doesn't choose to work 9 to 5 or say, hey, I'm not coming in Monday, I'm coming in Saturday instead. Okay. So, and that's kind of what we try to get out there, is the other side of the story and talk about that sort of thing. Another thing we talk about a lot are the myths and you know, fighting myths, you know, that pensions are bad. Pensions are corrupting us. If you have a pension and I don't have a pension, well, you should get rid of yours instead of I should have one too. Trickle-down economics. You know, I'm 43 years old. They started that when I was born. It really started getting traction. They started before I was born, but it really got traction as I was growing up, and it's been the biggest lie of my lifetime. Nothing has trickled down. Nothing's gotten better or cheaper or easier for us, and the wealth has slowly moved from the middle class to the 1%. And it's visible to us, but we still go, oh, yeah, it's a good idea, more tax cuts at the top. So our strategy is about affecting change, basically tie into organizing. You know, one thing that organized labor does well is get together and work well together. So we try to get to our allies. We try to share information, support each other, you know, get these cross-boundary information sessions together, work as allies, support each other. There's areas where we have, you know, training or we could just offer space for people to meet, you know, and work in those situations. I think in terms of city council, what I've learned over the years is a lot of times they just don't know. You know, you have a title and people assume that you have a specific education or knowledge about how things work. And if you aren't telling them another side of the story, if you aren't making them aware of stuff, they don't know. That old saying, if you don't know what you don't know, it's factual. So the wrong approach for me is to go in and say you're wrong, because they might not even know. And it's the importance of educating, but educating and saying, like, this is what we think you should do and why. Right? And I think also the importance of being visible. You know, get into newspapers, get into Facebook, share your message however you can, come to events like this and talk, be the voice. There's an older expression I heard once that, you know, people are thirsty for leadership. And in general, when you say something, there's a couple of people in the room who go, yeah, I feel like that too. I didn't think anybody else did. So the importance of having those difficult conversations, that pushing back when you hear something you disagree with, it's very valuable, because there's other people generally who feel the same way but just don't want to go through the struggle or frustration of arguing with somebody who they believe is wrong. And I'll stop there.
Oh. Sense to tie it together and then...
Just, I think the importance of it is just to get involved. And I think another thing you can pull away as a learning from this is how quickly 5 minutes goes by.
And now, Naomi Grant will talk a little bit about the Coalition for a Livable Sudbury and the things that they do to create change in the city.
So in a broad sense, what we're working toward is for well-being of people and well-being of nature to be what guides us as a city and as a society. And from that, we choose some really specific goals for change. Right now, those are around... people being able to be engaged in their city more easily, protecting our water and our water quality more effectively, and for people to be able to get around on transit, as you were just saying, and on their bike more easily. And we're looking at some really specific policies and changes in processes that we feel will make the biggest impact on those issues. And the basic idea is that you want to change how business as usual happens. So instead of fighting decisions as they happen, you want decisions and work to be done day to day in a way that causes those positive changes to be happening as part of the daily business of the city. That's kind of what we're heading towards. And in order to get there, we're basing that on a couple of things. One is getting information and education to the councillors and to other decision makers like top staff. So, you know, if you have good information, it's easier to make good decisions. And the more you hear about something, the more it becomes part of the conversation you have as decision makers. So we put quite a bit of effort. We regularly communicate with the councillors, and we talk about best practices, examples from other communities, local knowledge, local expertise, and what there is grassroots support for. And we do that, and we do our best to maintain a respectful relationship with them. We want an ongoing relationship to get them that information and to be seen as a resource and to provide well-validated information. We reference all our information. We make sure that it's accurate and that it's useful and relevant. The second big part is to really engage the public. So everything we do is grounded in what people tell us is important to them. So it's a bottom-up approach. So before we decide what issues we're talking about, we're hearing from the public. We're hearing from the community groups. We're hearing from people with local knowledge and local expertise, so that we can be sure that what we're working on is what people feel is most important and what makes the most impact on them. And really, we want to be connecting people to the decisions that impact them. So we do that because, as a matter of principle, we feel it's important that people have a say in things that matter to them. But also, you're generating political will. That's what democracy is. You're connecting the decision makers to the people they're making the decisions on behalf of. So basically, you're going through a process of finding out what's important to people, talking to people who really know about this, looking at examples, doing the research, having discussions with people, with groups, finding out what the most impactful action is, educating council, and then connecting people so that they not only have an individual voice, but then they can have a collective voice. They know who to call. They know what actions they can take. They know when the public hearings are, and they can have a voice individually and collectively on what matters to them. So that's simply kind of the process that we go through, and I think it does have broader relevance to almost any issue. You could work on any issue. We're a coalition of about 40 groups and several hundred people, so we've worked on quite a wide range of issues, all related to a better quality of life. And because we're a coalition, we really work hard on bringing people together and finding common goals. And I think that it's a process that any group can work with individually or collectively, and that could be applied to a whole wide range of issues.
And in the rest of this recording, you get to hear the panelists responding to and asking questions of each other.
Now is an opportunity for the folks at the front to ask each other some questions based on what they've just heard. So maybe we'll start with the folks from SCAP. Do you have any questions for the other panelists?
For Jamie West, I would ask about how you communicate with the workers or how the workers get involved in the Labor Council.
So we're organized already in terms of, you know, members of a union and unions being affiliated to the Labor Council. And we have sort of a trickle down. We can send messages to them. The most effective way are people who actually come to our meetings and we can speak to, right? So we'll put things on Facebook. We'll send email blasts out and stuff. But the face-to-face is the best method. And there's been a campaign that's been growing over the last year and a half that's called Together Fairness Works. And it talks about the member-to-member campaign and going back to sort of our grassroots of actually talking to the members. If you go to different unions, they'll talk about union meetings and how, you know, you have, I don't know, 100 members and only 25 show up, or you have 1,000 members and only 25 show up, and the frustration of it. But I think we don't do a very good job as leaders of unions of telling people why they want to come and that we want them to come, aside from putting a poster on the board saying, you know, every third Wednesday show up at a meeting. So the importance of having that conversation is really important, and we have our executive meeting actually next week, and that's going to be a big focus about getting more people involved, pulling more people in so that there are people who want to get involved and I think aren't sure how to find the door. You know, they just don't know where to start, and so making the door a little easier to find is important to us. But in general, you know, we do our best on sort of talking to each other, Facebook and email, to get a message out primarily.
So, yeah, go ahead, Anna.
I just wanted to address a couple of comments which I saw that had similarities that Naomi and Jamie presented. So, Jamie, I think you said that often city council or people who are in decision-making positions in the city don't know. And we just have to tell them what we think they should do and why. And often that is an effective thing to do. And similarly, Naomi, I think you said that part of what you focus on is informing council what they don't know about what matters to people, right? So from our perspective, I think where we begin is in recognizing that the state we're operating in is a capitalist state that creates massive inequality, it creates poverty, and it puts profit over people. Currently, there's a really obvious push towards austerity measures, which are making things even harder for people living in poverty and working people. And these are things that are actively created by and enforced by people working for the state, the local state included. So it's not just about telling them differently. Their role is to serve the function of the capitalist state. So I think it looks a little bit or a lot bit different than that for us in doing the work that we do.
So if you two want to respond to Anna's comment.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. And that, like, my personal feeling is that lots of different ways of organizing are important. So I think just as you engage in the system as it is when you help people with direct action in terms of getting their benefits, even though you'd rather they didn't even have to go and look for those benefits in the first place, there's always a balance between shifting the whole system to what you want it to be and making improvements within the system. And my personal feeling is that it's valid to do both. And I think also we distinguish between, like, the system and individual people. So we feel that people who run for council and are on council and many of the staff that work there, they may be part of a system, some aspects of which we may agree or disagree with, but as individuals, they're putting themselves forward out of good intentions to want to do something for the community, and we want to build a positive relationship with them and not depersonalize them as, like, a token of the system. So I guess that's maybe a difference in approach, but again, I think it's important that there's a spectrum of approaches that are used, because different people connect with different ways of taking action, and different people respond in different ways, and they all shift the conversation and the responses.
So I actually agree with what you're saying. What I meant by educate, though, is, so we had, there's a workers' memorial park in Valcairn, the Leo Gerard Worker Memorial Park, and this huge backlash from the right wing because Leo Gerard is a union activist, and God forbid we name someone after a union activist, right? And there's a really strong push, and city council was frustrated, and all, they went to slush fund and all this. It was just this complete nightmare, right? So what I learned through that experience is, I remember being at the final vote and Fabio Belli saying, oh, I Googled Leo Gerard. This guy's famous. So how do you, as a decision maker, make a decision without even, like, going on Google and saying, well, who is this guy anyways? Because I'll be honest, because of my age, I don't know who Tom Davies is, right? But if I was against Tom Davies Square being named against him, I think the first thing I would do is try to figure out who the guy was. I wouldn't just jump on the bandwagon. And so the point about educating isn't that, I'm just going to teach them and they'll go, oh, Jamie's right. The point is, I just assume that they might not know, right? So you talked earlier about the protest you guys had at City Council. I was there that night. It was a fantastic event, right? And what struck me out of it was there wasn't a person at City Council that night who didn't at some point talk about how cold it was or how long it took to warm up their cars. Or it was freezing. It was a cold winter, but that night especially was very, very cold. And so having the protest, I think for a lot of those people in the room, half the people in the room at least, the light clicks on for them that, yeah, it was really, really cold in my heated car. I wonder what it's like outside, right? And then thinking about just the idea of, well, yeah, there is a place they can go, but they can't sleep, as if in Sudbury it's only cold at night, and during the daytime they can have a nap in the warm park or something. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it was just this nonsense of, but people don't realize that, you know, when you're snuggled in your bed and no one tells you, you know, what life is like outside of your four walls. And that's what I meant by the educate part. It isn't just educate and walk away and hope they'll do something. It's the first step is to educate so they think about what the message is, so that when you say, and this is what we should do, they have a reason besides, I'm right and you're wrong. That's more what I was trying to get at.
And did you have a question, Jamie, for the other presenters?
No, I generally had comments. So I meet with them often and follow them on Facebook and stuff. So I want to acknowledge CLS. During the municipal campaign, the CLS website was probably the most informative in terms of what affects us day-to-day. Getting information from candidates that wasn't what the candidates just wanted to talk about. I thought it was very important that suddenly, as citizens, we become referred to as taxpayers. And a lot of our coverage is... how it's going to affect the markets and what's good for business and what's good for us as taxpayers. And really, day to day, we don't care about the tax. You know, nobody wants to pay their taxes and they want to have, be able to afford their means and stuff. But day to day, we're more focused on our kids, our families, you know, what we're breathing and stuff.
And so I really appreciate getting that angle of it, you know. So if you know me well or you follow me on Facebook, I'm one of those guys who's always, I like to take my bike out and I like to walk down trails and stuff. I really, really don't care. I don't understand why every news station has a stop ticker at the bottom, because I don't know how many people in this room follow stock that closely that they have to know by the minute how their stock is doing. But I'm going to say 1% of us, right? But every news channel has that. It doesn't have the stuff that we really care about and that affects us day to day. And this election, really, I talked earlier about the store hours. It focused on the store hours. I'm only going shopping once. I only have this much money for groceries. I'm going to get it on Monday or Tuesday. I'm not coming back because you're open Wednesday night. I'm just going to go once and get it. The rest of the week, I'm doing stuff with my family and people I care about. And so I just want to acknowledge that. And I wanted to make sure acknowledging the homeless protest. I thought it was just amazing. It was great. It was fantastic. And I think it was a good example of how we work together, well together, in terms of organized labor, you know, and then, I guess, unorganized. You guys are organized as well, but you don't have a local beside your name. Yeah. But just in terms of supporting each other, because I was moved by what you did. I wrote a letter to the editor about how frustrated I was with city council, because the mayor tried to clear the chamber room immediately, and one of the councilors got up like someone had offered free ice cream outside the door and like ran for the door and got booed back and shamed back into his seat. Very, very short, peaceful protest. You're the leaders of the city. I mean, listen to the people and give the opportunity to talk, right? So I think it's a good opportunity where we assist each other and we show that we're on the same page and we have that kind of solidarity.
Yay, solidarity!
That particular protest would have looked a lot different had the steelworkers not been there for other reasons, totally unrelated, and supported it. Having that extra support helped shape it.
So, did you want to talk a little bit about FTAP, your own... Sorry?
Stand up and talk.
And just talk a little bit about how you do the balance between your acknowledgement of like some basic societal organizations that are causing the problems you're working on and having to work within the system when you're going to places like City Hall and ODSP and all of those places. Like, how do you balance that in your work?
Okay, I think I can start to answer that. I think that an important point to clarify is that it's not entirely within. We're not working within that system. We're working against it, and we're not afraid to challenge it. We don't just do the types of low-level actions that are deemed acceptable by the state or by other people in society. We do direct action, which actually disrupts the functioning of the local state at various points, depending on what makes sense for the issue that we're focusing on. And we make them listen, because otherwise they won't.
Right. But when you're looking at what demands to ask, you know, sometimes to get a timely response, you need to be asking for a demand that's working with what's there, right?
Yeah.
So, like, probably you would want, ideally, a different shelter than you got, but what you needed was somewhere for somebody to sleep, somewhere warm.
Mm-hmm. It's not right? Our job.
Yeah, keep...
I don't think it's never SCAP's job to like to negotiate that or to decide which needs that people have take priority. We just fight for like the basic material needs that people have. But I think what it is about is the priorities of people with decision making power and where are they actually putting money. I don't buy it that there isn't money to put into an adequate homeless shelter, into fully funding the rates and policies of the community startup and maintenance benefit. So we would just continue to push for the demands that come out of working with people living in poverty.
Did you want to say something?
I would just add to that that it really is looking for what concrete demands. SCAP does have an anti-capitalist perspective on things, but we are looking for the concrete, what people have asked for right here,
yeah.
And just echoing the concerns that we hear from conversations when people come to us because they have a problem.
So I think before we open it up for questions more generally, I want to extend the question that Jamie got asked about sort of getting people involved and active to the other two groups, to talk to SCAP and then CLS, talk about how do you mobilize people to become actively engaged with the work that you're doing in the community.
We could always do better. I think all of us can do better at that. But the approach we take is just to get information to people and make it easy for them to know what those opportunities are to speak up. So, you know, we're out in the community at different events. We go out and sign people up. People often will come to us now because if they have a certain issue, they'll have heard about us and they want to know, okay, what can I do? Who do I talk to? What are the rules anyways? Like, what's going on? So we connect with people in lots of different ways, and we put out a regular newsletter and action update, which kind of covers all sorts of different areas so people know, okay, what are the meetings I can go to? What are the actions I can participate in, whether it's an SCAP action or whether it's a green silent auction supporting a different type of group. So a whole range of different ways people can get involved so that they can focus on what's important to them and what they're comfortable with in terms of acting. And then in our own group, if we work, we have project-based work, so if we're starting a new project, we just put a call out to our members, who's interested in this, who wants to work on it, let's get together and make this happen. And that's been successful for us so far, but we could always do better in engaging more people, and especially more people in the day-to-day work, which maybe is less exciting than putting on a town hall for the mayoral candidates, things like that.
Okay, so I think that we also participate in the types of things like having a website and social media outreach and to try to like broaden awareness about the issues that we focus on. And we also have like a phone that people can call at any time to talk about any of their day-to-day struggles that we could assist them with through direct action support work. And I already went through that direct action support work process as a way to determine the demands that we make and the struggles that we engage in. But it's like a continual process, and it doesn't stop just there. As I mentioned also earlier, that we do postering and leafletting and have face-to-face conversations with people living in poverty at the places where they're at, like hanging out downtown, at the soup kitchen, at the mission, just having conversations with people who are living this reality to see what concerns them, to talk to them about our campaigns, about our approaches, and about how we can move forward and keep fighting.